Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, this is Dr. John Stamey, and I am welcoming you to the one, the only Scary Cast. We've got a great show tonight. We're going to have a lot of fun, and it's definitely going to be a Scary Cast. You know, as I was looking at the title of this, John LeMay on Vampires, Werewolves, and Mummies. This is what I grew up on when I was in the fourth grade, and I watched those old Universal films, those great Universal horror films with werewolves, the great Lon Chaney Jr., vampires with the great Bela Lugosi, and, of course, mummies with none other than Boris Karloff. So you know what? Our love of monsters has really not changed so much in a half a century. It really hasn't. We still like the same monsters. And tonight, we have a co-host. Right now, he has so many names, but Mark Johnston is here with us from Niagara Falls, Canada. We're pleased to have him here. How are you doing tonight, Mark?
Hey, John. So I'm doing okay. Yeah, I was in Niagara Falls today, the tourist area, walking around. Things seem to be coming back to life post-COVID, so hopefully things continue that way, and soon enough I'll be able to come down to Clayton, Georgia, for the Georgia Bigfoot Conference.
The Grand Georgia Bigfoot Conference, which is April the 16th at the Raven County Civic Center in Clayton, Georgia. And also put on your calendar, we have the Chamber of Commerce After Hours sponsored by the Georgia Bigfoot Conference. That is on April 7th. And that's at, again, Raven County Civic Center. So we got a lot of things going on down there. We also have the Georgia Holistic Conference, which is going to be September the 24th. That's going to be a biggie. And then, of course, the one, the only Bigfoot Christmas celebration. That will be December 2nd and 3rd in Clayton, Georgia. On December the 3rd, we will have Bigfoot walking down the street with Santa Claus. And we will be performing with a couple of kids' choirs. We will be performing Blessings from Bigfoot, the new musical by none other than Dr. John Stamey, and it's going to be so much fun. And the great author, New York Times best-selling author and movie star, Tory Martin, will be there to do a reading from his brand new book about Yeti and Christmas. So, I mean, it's going to be December the 3rd is going to be the best Bigfoot day that you could ever have. So be sure to come on down to Clayton, Georgia. I'll have more about it on the website on scarycastpodcast.com and also on the brand new show that Mark Johnston and I have. It's called Scary Talk. Got a lot of cool stuff going on there. This week we're going to be talking about Black Swan events. Next week we're going to be talking with Bigfoot explorer Matt Delf, our buddy from Eastern Tennessee. So it's going to be a lot of fun, and we got great things going on here at Scary Cast and Scary Talk. So stay tuned, keep up with what we're doing, and you will enjoy it, I promise. Well, tonight, and by the way, the Queen of Scary Cast, Robin McCrae, is on her way. She's not here just yet, but she will be there. She sometimes has little emergencies, and so she's got a hall pass to finish whatever tonight's brought her. And we have the one and only, the great John LeMay, author, speaker, television star from Roswell, New Mexico. Good evening, John, and it's a pleasure to have you back with us.
Good evening. It's always good to be back on Scary Cast, and I think your new show sounds awesome, so I'll have to listen to that sometime.
Well, great. It's a little more conspiracy theory based, but as I listed on the Facebook page, it's conspiracy theories, horror movies, paranormal, and interesting people. So we're going to have all four of them, and it's a little different format than we have on Scary Cast, because on Scary Cast we have a Surgeon General, we have a well-known Bigfoot experiencer and psychic, we have a comedian from Hollywood, and we have our favorite dude from Canada, Mark Johnston. So it's just me and Mark talking like we're having one of our standard phone calls. And it's just and some people said, well, why don't y'all put that up on the air? I said, sure, we'll be glad to. And that will be immediately following Scary Cast on WLSC AM and FM Myrtle Beach, Conway, and Loras. So you can catch it there on all over the Myrtle Beach and Conway market. It's going to be huge. It's going to be a lot of fun. So anyway, that's the little plug there. And John LeMay, what are you going to talk about? I kind of spilled the beans a little bit earlier when I said, you know what? In 50 years, we still love vampires. We love werewolves, and we love the mummy. Even Brendan Fraser. I love those mummy movies with him. Did you like them, John LeMay?
Oh, absolutely. I loved them.
Great. Well, tell us about you've got a brand new book, and what's it called?
Okay. Well, you know, first, you know, Noe Torres and I, we started doing those The Real Cowboys and Aliens, and that led to me doing Cowboys and Saurians, you know, about the dinosaur sightings. So I started a third series now because, you know, in addition, you know, you've got your aliens and you got your dinosaurs, but you've also got your supernatural type monsters like vampires and werewolves that allegedly do exist, even though people kind of think they're just movie monsters. Based on folklore, you know, people today do still see werewolves and vampires like the Beast of Bray Road, probably the most famous one we have today. So my new book is called Cowboys and Monsters, Vampires, Mummies, and Werewolves of the Wild West. So it's all just period accounts of these supernatural monsters, either through just oral folklore passed down through generations or real newspaper articles. So I thought I'd share a few of those tonight. And I can't remember if we'd ever talked about The Vampire of the Range on, I think, from Nebraska. Did we ever talk about that on here? Because that's one of my chapters.
No, tell us about him or her or it.
Okay, this is, yeah, so interesting. So, okay, I think a lot of skeptical people, when they hear about a vampire article from the 1890s, they're going to think, well, whoever the reporter was just made up a story because, you know, Dracula was just published. Well, Dracula by Bram Stoker was published in 1897, and the story I'm going to talk about was published 2 years before that in 1895, and it's set in kind of on the border of Nebraska and South Dakota, kind of in between those two states. And the article is pretty exciting. It's titled Human Vampire, and the headline goes, Strangles Cattle with His Bare Hands. His wonderful strength, attempts to capture him prove futile. No one knows who the madman is. Thrilling experience of a Dakota cowboy. So the article, it's not too long, so I'll go ahead and read it. And it's an exciting article. It's not one of those just that just drags on and on. It's a good one. So it begins, the cattlemen on the ranges of west of Pierre, South Dakota, tell a ghastly story of a madman who for some time past has been roaming over the reservation, killing cattle with his naked hands to suck their blood, and in some cases even attacking men. No one seems to know who the man is, nor how long he has been wandering the ranges. He was first seen some 4 or 5 weeks ago. Repeated attempts have been made to capture him, but thus far without success. He is said to labor under the hallucination that he is a vampire. How he manages, without a weapon of any kind, to kill the cattle on which he lives is a mystery. When found after he has left them, the animals appear to have been seized by the heads, borne to the ground by brute strength, and torn to pieces by the teeth and nails of the lunatic. So just, if I were to interject, I don't think he sounds like he thinks he's a vampire. It sounds like he really might be a vampire, because I don't think I could wrestle a cow to the ground and then tear it apart with my teeth. So that's what this article is saying. And it also predates, you know, the really popular Chupacabra legend, which I also think is interesting, but I just wanted to interject that. But okay, to continue with the article, it says, Jack Lewis, a cowboy on one of the ranches about midway between Pierre and the Black Hills, is the hero of the most exciting adventure with the madman yet reported. It was nearly a fortnight ago Lewis had been out for several days with a party on the range, and about 6 o'clock in the evening, he wandered away from his companions and dismounted for a few moments. Now, I do want to take a second to point out that when this story was published, it was published in November, you know, and I assume back then they had the whole time change deal. So by 6 p.m. in November, I assume it was probably dark outside. So I just wanted to point out, you know.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay.
Absolutely, because long time ago, by 4:30 on December 23rd, it was getting dark. So by, you know, and that's that was in North Carolina. So I mean, it would be pitch black in November in Pierre, South Dakota, in that area. It certainly would. That's just a little comment I've got to. I got a story like you wouldn't believe about that. Anyway, go ahead, please, kind sir.
Okay, and maybe we can circle back to your story later, too, because I'm intrigued. But, yeah, so to continue the article, it says Jack Lewis wandered away from his companions and dismounted for a few moments. As he stood by his horse, he was suddenly struck from behind and hurled to the ground and nearly strangled by the maniac. He struggled furiously but was unable to reach his weapon. While his assailant frothed at the mouth and made every effort to seize the cowboy by the throat with his teeth, such wonderful strength did he display that Lewis was nearly overpowered and would doubtless have been killed and had not his friends, attracted by his cries, arrived in time to rescue him. The madman flew when he saw this reinforcement coming, and although pursued by several men on fast horses, again, they're on horses, not on foot, he managed to elude them in the dusk and made his escape. Jack Lewis was quite badly torn about the face and neck by the man's teeth and received a shock from which he has not yet fully recovered. And that's where the article ends. There's no follow-up article, which kind of discouraged me at first, and I did kind of poke around some of the area historical societies to ask them, you know, have you ever heard of this story? And I had asked one of the South Dakota Historical Societies if they'd heard of it, and they hadn't, couldn't find a Jack Lewis. But the Nebraska State Historical Society, because, again, you know, this story took place in a region between Nebraska and South Dakota, kind of a shared region called the Black Hills, so they both claim it. But the Nebraska State Historical Society does acknowledge the story. They did a lengthy write-up on it once. But I don't think they could necessarily prove whether or not Jack Lewis was real either. And that's a pretty common name, which actually makes it harder to search in some ways. You know, when you have a very distinct name, it's easier to single out. But, you know, so it's kind of hard to prove whether or not Jack Lewis is real.
How many,
yeah.
John LeMay, how many athletes are named John Lewis or Jack Lewis? I mean, seriously.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's an impossible task when you get a common name. I know that I have done that a lot in my writing, and so you're 100% right. It makes it even more difficult. It does.
Yeah, and this story, you know, I was ready to write it off as a one-off, and there's nothing wrong with one-off stories. They could be true, but it's just typically if it really happened, you'll have a follow-up or an ancillary story that backs it up. Well, after I'd kind of finalized the book, I found, because the book's not out yet, I'm just proofing it, but before I was ready to finalize it, I found a story that's related. And I'm pleased because I'm the first person to ever connect this other story with the Nebraska story. So they also had a vampire attack a few months before that. So again, okay, so the Black Hills, Nebraska, South Dakota vampire story, again, that was first published in November of 1895. So in April of 1895, they also had another vampire attack in Iowa, which is not far from Nebraska. You know, it's like the bordering state. So I thought that was really interesting that you'd have a vampire attack in Iowa, and then what would that be? 7 months later, you have one in the neighboring state. So, I mean, let's say it's the same vampire. It could have easily traveled all that distance in 7 months. So the article, though, about the Iowa vampire, published 1895 on April 25th, it reads, A wealthy rancher named Converse met a horrible death at Sioux City, Woodbury County, Iowa, on Wednesday. There is a maniac confined in the Sioux City Lunatic Asylum who imagines himself a vampire and is considered excessively dangerous. A close watch was kept over him, but he managed to elude the vigilance of the guards and escaped on Wednesday morning. Not long afterwards, he met Mr. Converse on the high road. He sprang at him in a fury, bore Converse to the ground, and literally tore him to pieces with his teeth. When Converse ceased to struggle, the maniac fastened on his neck and sucked the blood from a gaping wound. He then returned to the asylum, where his shocking appearance showed the asylum officials that something dreadful had happened. Search was made when the mangled body of the maniac's victim was discovered, mutilated almost beyond recognition. And that's where the article ends. But again, April 1895, November 1895, and I calculated somewhere. So, okay, Sioux City, Iowa, and the Pine Ridge region are about 350 miles apart. So, again, it's not inconceivable that this was the same guy who perhaps escaped the asylum again from Sioux City and ran off to the Pine Ridge region and continued his reign of terror. So, other researchers discovered those two articles, and they're fairly well known, but I think I'm the only one that's kind of hypothesized that, well, why couldn't this be the same vampire, you know, because of the proximity. What do you guys think?
I want to welcome the Queen of Scarycast, Robin McCray, is here. How are you doing tonight, Robin?
I am good. I'm sorry I'm late. We are in the middle of a Orangeburg power outage. Go power.
Really?
Yeah, we have no power here, so if I lose you, it's my cell phone is dwindling out of power. I'm good for now. So I apologize, everybody. John, it's great to hear you.
It's okay. Listen, we're glad to have you. By the way, I'll say that Trey has a hall pass. He is taking a well-earned vacation after Camden Irish Fest, and Devin is practicing for an important performance next Monday night, and so he'll be back 2 weeks from tonight. But now, Robin, I want to ask you. So we've got you and me and Mark Johnston, and we've got, of course, John LeMay. And I want to ask you first, in case your power just ultimately dwindles down, what is your experience with vampires, and what do you think about these two stories? I think they're absolutely fascinating. I mean, I've got this thing.
Well, I
got this thing for vampires.
I think they're intriguing. My own personal opinion on the vampire thing is a little bit mixed, but I haven't had a lot of experience with it. As you know, I deal more with the cryptids and the paranormal and everything coming out of dimensions in the sky and everything else. So that is one thing that so far has not followed me around. So I'm not really sure. As far as the stories themselves, I thought they were extremely interesting. You know, and I think the only way we learn any information on any of this stuff is the more stories we hear. Because it's not like it's out there, you know, this is it. I mean, and really, in all the books that are out, and John, your books are phenomenal. They are really good.
Thank you.
And so, but regardless of who writes the books, we have no way to know what's real, what's true and what isn't. The only thing we know is what we experience. So
well, I have a few things I'd like to potentially add in with this, which is it seems that region that it's like rancher region or like the kind of the West during that time. Isn't this kind of the same area where there's a lot of the cattle mutilations? And aren't some of these cattle mutilations having to do with they find that like there's certain blood and organs removed and that type of thing? And the other thing I want to mention is going back in the day, even with old British royalty, they used to be cannibals and drink blood. And look into that, and they're finding out now that blood transfusions are actually like a life extension technique. So what if there was a crude way that kind of the elites at the time knew this and was like remove people's blood, like kind of like a black market organ thing of these days, you know what I mean? And that could have been seen as vampires at the time too, like either literally drinking it, like I know that there's some like this one what's that one country in Africa, Liberia or Libya, there was like a war there. And there's this one general that used to drink the blood, and he felt like you'd get high off it. You know, when you drink like almost cannibalistic. And so maybe there's almost like a drug effect as well with it, with like drinking cannibalism itself or drinking human blood. And this is something that maybe psychopaths stumble across one way or another. Like if they killed their subject and then drank their blood, they found that it kind of enraged them and like went on like a wild lunatic kind of thing. So it could be a combination of, I think, a number of these few things.
Oh, Mark, I love that because, like, you had all kinds of interesting stuff on the head because I'm not one who believes in, like, the Stoker vampires, which are more from myth because Stoker made a lot of things up, even though he kind of based it on truth or, you know, folklore and stuff. But, yeah, so I agree with you there that probably, like, a quote-unquote real vampire wouldn't be like what we see in the movies, but is just kind of a human who somehow manages to drink blood, because they say a normal person shouldn't be able to ingest that and it should make them sick, but apparently some crazy people can. So to go down the conspiracy theory rabbit hole, another theory could be that these so-called vampires are just people that are possessed by a demon, and the demon craves the blood, and when the demon inhabits that body, perhaps they can drink the blood and ingest it as opposed to if they weren't possessed. So maybe that's another option. And then they just call vampires.
That's a very interesting option.
I'm just reading this article right here. It's from BBC, so it's a reputable source. The super rich are injecting blood from teenagers to gain immortality. Now, Now that's what's going on these days with modern technology. Now, if there maybe was a crude way back in the day that, you know, if you think like a lord of like, you know, one of these countries, Prince of Netherlands or something was knew this information and was like, you know, injecting itself, they would maybe, it's just like modern day organ trafficking where like, you know, they kidnap people and like, they might find somebody, they might've found somebody with all their blood taken and be like, oh, it's a vampire. But it was really just somebody who like, you know, took their blood out.
There's a lot of crazy out there.
It's just a hypothesis when it comes to that, like, as far as vampires go. And I think we are seeing that modern-day vampires. Like, if you think about the whole concept of it, it's like, you know, taking somebody else's life energy and putting it in you, and that's how they survived, right? And that's kind of what modern-day blood transfusions are, a way. And I know a lot of elite, like, George Soros and, like, Rockefeller types, they're like, they probably had, like, 12 heart transplants by now. You know, they're just being, like... changing their engine, you know what I mean, in their car, in their body, like that's how they're extending themselves. The super rich are already doing that. We can see that.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. And Mark, that gives me a perfect segue to the next story, because I found an even better vampire story. I mean, it's not like I'm the only one who's ever found this. A million people have found this story before me, and I'm just regurgitating it from my book. But so I did find a story about an elite, you know, as we'd say, who supposedly survived through the ages, named Saint Germain. Does that ring a bell with any of y'all, Saint Germain?
Oh my God, yes. There's the Saint Germain Society. It's in Ohio. I've done a lot of work on him. That man lived several hundred years. Now he just did. And that's what I think.
Yeah,
there are accounts of him all over Europe through several centuries, and it wasn't his son, it was him, and there was something about him that was not right. So please continue, John.
Yeah, so we'll start, instead of starting with the historical Saint Germain from the time of like King Louis the 15th, I think it was, or whenever, we're going to start in 1904. In New Orleans, Louisiana, which is funny because in pop culture, you know, New Orleans and Louisiana is very much associated with vampires, you know, thanks to Anne Rice's novels, and I think the True Blood series was set in the South, so it's interesting that New Orleans has so many ties to potentially real vampires. So in 1904...
Well, I'll mention the story after you finish, but it absolutely does. New Orleans is the hub of that.
Yeah. So 1904, this guy had just moved there named Jacques Saint Germain, you know, just a wealthy socialite, always throwing parties and stuff like that at his estate. And one night the guests were leaving the party and they saw this girl fall off the balcony. or they at least they thought she fell. So they went up to help her, and the girl was screaming, and it turns out she didn't fall. She jumped off the balcony, and she said that she jumped because Jacques Saint Germain bit her neck and tried to drink her blood, and she was so scared she would rather jump off the balcony. And so the police came, and, you know, the girl was a prostitute, so the police didn't really care about her or believe her. You know, they believed the rich elite guy because he was like, oh, she's just a drunk prostitute. Of course, I didn't bite her on the neck. But the police, you know, they didn't bug St. Germain that night. They said, would you please come into the station tomorrow morning to give us a statement? And so tomorrow morning came, and Germain never came in. So they went to his house, and they searched it. And they found all these tablecloths in the drawers that were stained with blood, for starters. And then the more interesting thing that they found, and as far as I understand, this is actually a fact. At least I got the impression this is a fact, and it's not folklore. They found wine bottles that had a mixture of wine and human blood in them. So he was a blood drinker, and he fled, never to be seen again in New Orleans after that. But after this happened, people started to reflect on his parties, you know, and they said that, you know, come to think of it, at his parties, we never saw him eat food. We only saw him drink from a chalice, and he never had any actual silverware or cutlery in his home. He had all of his parties catered, so he never had any food in his house like a normal human being, and he had a portrait of the old Saint Germain from the 18th century. He had a portrait of Saint Germain, and would say, "Oh, that's my great ancestor," like Dr. John was saying, and you know, people said, "Oh, y'all look just alike," and so you know, then people started to dig around, and you know, John can probably talk about this more, but yeah, Saint Germain, the old Saint Germain from the 18th century, you know, people thought that he had lived forever. They said that he could speak every language. He was multi-talented. He was an alchemist. But yeah, Dr. John, I mean, you know so much about him. Do you want to just take over and talk some about that historical Saint Germain?
Well, here's what I can say. Saint Germain, the one that we know from the 18th century, was a sorcerer. Okay. He knew alchemy. He could do miraculous things. He was a favorite of many European courts, you know, where, you know, the royalty just loved him. He was entertaining. He was educated. And he seemed to travel around and never age. I can't speak to what happened to him, but he was a sorcerer, and I know that for a fact, he was a sorcerer, and he did practice the black arts. Now, it seems as though the Saint Germain Society in Ohio is not so big on the sorcery part as they are his teachings, but we don't know where he is. We don't know what's going on with him. He became fabulously wealthy. Because he lived so long. And, you know, let's face it. I mean, as a guy, I'm a certified hedge fund professional. And I can say that in 60 years, an average worker may not make a lot of money. But in 200 years, an average worker can amass a fortune. And so who knows? So that's about what I know about. I mean, I've got a book on my bookshelf about Saint Germain, the Comte de Saint Germain. And he's a very interesting character. He was a fortune teller and prophet, much like, well, you know, Rasputin and Nostradamus. But he was a little bit more civil than they were. You know, those guys were kind of rough around the edges. One was a Russian, and he was really rough around the edges, Rasputin. But he was, you know, very refined, dressed well, and entertained the various royalty. And so, and then he apparently vanished around the mid 1850s. So now, please tell me, when did you clocked him in 1903 in New Orleans, correct?
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what,
that
is something that you and I need to discuss offline, because I think that's
I've got another sighting for you, too. I can tell you his last modern sighting. I've got it right here. Let's see. Okay, after New Orleans, he was next sighted in Rome in 1926 by a Freemason named C.W. Leadbeater, and he claimed that Germain told him that he was currently living in a castle in Transylvania. So there's another vampire connection. So in Leadbeater's book, The Masters of the Path, he claimed that Germain told him that when he performed magic rituals in his Transylvania castle, he wore a suit of golden chainmail, which once belonged to a Roman emperor. And then I guess his last known sighting was at Mount Shasta, which sounds appropriate, in 1930.
Are you
so
serious?
That's the last one.
That is incredible.
Uh-huh,
Mount Shasta. Oh my God.
Mount Shasta should be one of the places on the planet.
Yes, it is, Robin. Thank you.
For lack of a better way to put it, it really is. I mean, there's like literally portals all over Mount Shasta. They've had people walk right into them and disappear, not to mention everything else that's up there.
Well, I tell you what, John LeMay, we will talk offline about this. I think there's some really interesting things.
Good.
So is there a chapter in your book about the Comte de Saint-Germain?
Yeah, there is. So that's what I was kind of looking over as we talked. And you, before you forget, you had a New Orleans vampire story yourself, I think.
I will condense it into the following. There is a club, like a bar kind of club, in New Orleans that's filled with red lights, and humans don't need to go in that they don't need to go there. Okay, they won't come out alive.
Oh, wow.
And that's Pardon me?
I said I've never heard of that before. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, I know what it looks like. I was privileged to at least see it from the outside, and I knew not to go in. And local legend kind of tells that you don't need to go in there unless you don't want to come out alive. So it's kind of a frightening place. Don't know what happens there. I didn't want to go find out.
Well, you know, John, there's like a whole bunch of things. Like, I don't know if you heard of the NXIM cult. It's kind of like this crazy cult. And there's other ones also where, like, you know, we all know about Jeffrey Epstein now and things. I believe there's some underground societies where, like, it's almost like they condition you, like, a cult to, like, all these warped things. And potentially, like, to be a part of the club, it just escalates further, more disturbing and disturbing things until you're either bribed or blackmailed. I believe that's what's happening with a lot of people in the world, and it's just like a sick thing. Like when you go deeper down the psychopathic road of things, there's potentially like the elites where they have as much money, they can do whatever they want. It's like Epstein Island, if you look at all of the flight logs to this guy's place and what the warp things they're doing that the media is not even talking about, I believe that there's like some real cannibalism things going on. Like, I'm sure there's like restaurants in Hollywood and New York where you go and you can eat humans, as well as other places in the world. And I'm sure there's like some weird after parties where you go to and they might assassinate somebody right in front of you. I've heard of these things happening. So I wouldn't doubt
that
like kind of psychopathic things, but as well kind of like occult ritualistic things. Like, if you remember that one movie, Stanley Kubrick, what was it, Eyes Wide Shut type thing? Like, potentially some weird things going down.
Well, I have a friend who was part of that type of experience in Colorado, and can't discuss his name. But we have talked about this, and there was some of that going on in Colorado. So we'll just leave it at that. And you know, I worry about having three vodkas in an evening, and they're doing all this. So I think I can. I'm a little bit underwhelming here, you know. I mean, but anyway, that's okay. John, you have, first of all, I want to say greetings to everybody from WLSC AM and FM, Loris, Myrtle Beach, Conway, South Carolina. We appreciate being on Banana Jack Murphy's radio station, And we're glad you're here listening to us on the greatest radio station in Myrtle Beach. So thanks a lot for being here. And back to you, John LeMay. You have sparked some incredibly wonderful discussions. And as I said, some that we'll discuss offline, and I think that would be appropriate. So now, please continue, kind sir.
Yeah, I just want to say how at home I feel here, because, I mean, I can say things that other people would think is crazy, and, you know, then Mark says the same thing. And Mark, I've heard of the Cannibal Club in New York, which, you know, they kind of tease that where you hide is in plain sight, and they gave that place the name. Who wants to eat at the Cannibal Club? I don't. And that's where the elites ate, and they say that was really one of the spots where people got served up. But anyway.
Well, John, I'll tell you one story, but I want to hear more you said. So I used to live in a place called Ibiza, Spain, which is like party capital of the world, and that's where the rich and famous go with yachts and things. And my roommate at the time was a DJ, and he would DJ for parties like we're essentially billionaires, like the guy who owned Mentos or like some crazy things. And he's saying that they have a whole bunch of crazy drugs that like they do recreationally that we never even heard of. And I think he thought that it potentially was derived from humans, like our like brains and things. And he's saying that they're even like, he heard of like ritual abuse going on in these places where it's like with like pedophile type things and other things, but they were like, you know, you have to keep your mouth shut, or we're billionaires. Like, we'll find you and kill you if you say anything. But they also, like, he was paid a lot of money to like DJ these parties of like really rich, like yacht famous people, Saudi princes and things. And I think that there's a whole thing going on with life extension and just like essentially like consuming humans going on in the rich and at elite level things. And this has been going on for a lot in history. That's my hypothesis.
Yeah, I agree, because I think the only, I mean, a lot of them probably did it, but the only one we kind of all know about for sure is that Elizabeth Bathory that bathed in the blood of virgins and all that. But I'm sure others did, and they just managed to keep it a secret.
Well, frankly, they don't need to be going to all those lengths. They can do it without that. I just need to call 843-655-8775, and I'll tell them. But anyway, Robin, what is your final take on this moment in time of John LeMay's story? Because I'd love to hear it. And if you have any input from MindSpeak.
I like to listen to this stuff because this is, you know, out of what I normally deal with. So I find it very fascinating, you know. I do, in all aspects, from whether or not some of these things are, you know, when you get talking about like the vampires and stuff, and you have people that are they actually a vampire? Do they have a mental illness? It's just a lot of things. And so, John, I love your stuff because when you come on, you've got all these great stories that are all in the books, of course. But it's interesting. It's a whole different situation than what I'm used to, so I enjoy listening to everybody's take on it.
Well, thank you. I have a feeling we could probably talk about this one book the entire rest of the year because, you know, this one I kind of wanted it to be a menagerie of just different monsters that we were all familiar with from the Universal movies. Like I found only one on like a potential invisible man, not like a ghost, but like an actual invisible man. I found one of those. I found some real life,
Dad,
you know, creature from the Black Lagoon.
You might like them.
Okay.
An invisible. I have this picture, and it looks like a man. It really does. I mean, it looks like the round head, the nose, the eyes, the mouth.
Oh.
And it's the craziest thing. He's looking out from around the tree. There's no way to miss him. And when I took the picture, I couldn't see him at all, and he showed up perfectly, and you can see right through him. But it looks like a man.
Wow.
And I can't say it looks like a ghost, but it looks like a man. It's crazy looking. It looks like a bald-headed man. Yeah, I think I've got you on my Facebook friend. I'll send it to you.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I'd love to.
Style. It looks like a human blob that's sticking out from around this tree.
So when it comes to vampires and things, it's like if there was that idea that like vampires like either drank blood or extracted it and used it. Like I just watched this X-Files episode where he like there was there were vampires that lived. They were like age-defying, defying people, and they connected their arteries to other hosts, and then extracted the blood. If there's that type of thing, if you think of transfusion, it's what makes the blood life extension wise, and I think a big part of it is that they're kind of they're called these pluripotent cells, they're stem cells and things like that, as well as the blood plasma in itself, has very hormone properties and other properties. And if you think of things in hormones that are anabolic or growth oriented, keep the cells growing and keep them doing their things, that's where it's a lot of it's located. And if there's some way that you could use it, blood for life extension, I think there's that possibility where you could potentially live a lot longer or a lot extended life.
Humans were originally made to live longer. Mm-hmm. We were never made to die out as quick as we are.
Mm-hmm.
They claim that it's going to change. What did they say? 2000, what is it? 26. I think it was 2000. I can't remember. It was the mid-2000s, and whatever that is being done to us and put in our food and other things shortened our lifespan. We were supposed to live hundreds of years, and we don't anymore. And they're supposed to, as they reduce the population, they're going to start undoing what they've been doing, so we'll live longer.
Well, now stem cells, surgery, I know people who've got it on their knees. I work in massage, and I've heard people, they go to Mexico or Panama or something and get this done, and they swear by it. They're like, yeah, yeah, it works. Because I'm always interested, because I hate to see people getting knee replacements and things. I'd rather prevent that. But they're going down. They're getting this, so it's regenerated. It's like regenerating areas of the body that doesn't have good blood flow to it, doesn't have good regeneration in itself. And I think, just that in itself, which is a relatively new science in kind of modern medicine for regenerating health, I think that just proves that things like stem cells and whatever, just life extension factors to go on that kind of thread of vampires, because that's what they are. They live to supposed to live to hundreds of years, right? So on that kind of note, I think there's some validity there.
Well, in the Bible, there were people that lived 600 and 700 years old. And
they
think
say that we're supposed to.
Exactly. We're not supposed to, expire and die at 77 or 85. I mean, people are getting unnaturally old quickly. And right now, I think I have zero clients, of about 200 clients that are every one of them's on blood pressure medicine. And, 100 mm-hmm. years ago, no one was on blood pressure medicine. They didn't have this. And people lived a long time. You got it.
Look at the monks, and then you go up way, way, way up in the mountains and, all these different countries, and they all live by themselves. They don't have modern medicine. They don't have processed food from the grocery store. They live off the land. They live off what they can hunt. And you find these people that are well over 100 years old, and they're still walking around doing their thing. It's what we eat.
They don't look like what we consider to be 100 years old, do they, Robin?
No, they look a lot better than I do.
That's Okinawa, Japan, is the longest life expectancy area.
Mm.
And there's something called the Okinawa diet, and it's very unique, but obviously it involves a lot of fish and rice, or Japanese, right? But it's, again, organic foods and certain types of fats. We're so anti-fat in the West, but some fats are good, and fish oils and things like that. I think omega acids, I think that's the key part. If we talk about focus on nutrition, I think they've proved themselves, as well as the Greek diet as well.
Well, I've got an interesting story about that, Mark, and it involves me. My father and all of his Army buddies from World War II, they all ended up with clogged, carotid arteries, and every one of them had to have surgery to clean them out. Now, when I had a medical event exactly a year ago from today, or from February 28th, I was terrified that I would have the same problem, because I eat a lot of fats in my diet, and the fats that I eat are olive oil and they're butter. And a girl came in and did a scan of my arteries, and she said, oh, my God. I said, oh, no, what? And I was just thinking I'm going to have surgery. She said, I've never seen arteries as clean and open as yours. I said, are you serious? She said, yes. What do you do? I said, I eat lots of butter and lots of olive oil. No trans, I quit trans fats. No margarine, none of that. She said, well, whatever you're doing, it's working. And it was amazing that she said that. And then, of course, she didn't put that exactly the way she said it on her report, but it was good enough to get me out of there quickly. But the fact is that natural fats are things that our body needs. And so, you know, when these people say, oh, low fat, they're crazy. They don't know what they're talking about. Because the high-fat diet with the appropriate fats is fine. That's why farmers live so long, because they eat pork fat and they eat butter. And
well,
they don't have a problem.
Live off grid. They live longer, too. I said the people that live off grid. They don't
stand
in the grocery store every other day. You know, they're eating off the land. The produce they get is fresh. It's not, you know, taken to the grocery store with pesticides or whatever and washed off. I mean, it's a whole different ballgame. And it was really interesting. I saw it on two different shows that they were talking about this, that our life expectancy should have been almost to 200 years old. And it's been reduced because of what's been put in our food, but that whatever this is, they're supposed to stop doing it. But it was like, I want to say, in the 2040 or 2050 year, you know, so we probably might now see it, but some of us will. And it's supposed to lengthen your life. The health issues are going to be lower and everything. Right now, the pharmaceutical companies and the doctors make money because we're sick all the time.
Wow. All right, well, John May, I know you're our guest. We had some interesting conversation and back and forth. So now, sir, would you please continue? We'd love to hear more stories from your upcoming book. And what's the name of it?
Yeah, Cowboys and Monsters, Vampires, Mummies, and Werewolves of the Wild West. And so digging up the mummy stories was a little more challenging than the vampires. Because, you know, what'd you say, John?
I was going to say, you have some werewolf stories. Those are cool.
I do. So here's what really happened as I was doing this book. It kept just growing and growing till it was like over 500 pages. So I've decided to do, this is kind of like what I call a best of book with all sorts of stuff in it. But in the future, I'm going to do a book that's just North American period era vampire stories, and another one that's just North American werewolves, and another one that's just mummies. But this one, like I said, was kind of all the coolest, more Old West stuff that involved all three. I even have a story in here about how Jack the Ripper allegedly left London for Benson, Arizona, and became a bartender there, and that's where Jack the Ripper supposedly died in this Wild West shootout. I have a chapter on that. So werewolves. Yeah, so but for werewolves, I had trouble finding, even though the title is Werewolves of the Wild West, I had trouble finding traditional werewolves in the West. Most of them were more in regions where the French had settled, because the French had those werewolf legends. So there was one like in Detroit, in the kind of the French area, and kind of in the South where the French had also settled. So I was kind of disappointed I didn't have a great traditional Southwest werewolf. Now, what we do have, though, in the Southwest, of course, is the skinwalkers, which they're different from a werewolf, because a werewolf, you know, according to the legend, it bites you and you turn into a wolf. Well, a skinwalker, to do that, you don the animal cloak that you want to turn into, and then there's kind of like a ritual where you have to kill a close blood relative to finally gain your final powers and all that. So they're a little different. But the skinwalker thing is still an issue today, because there's Native American people I know and Hispanic people I know. And I say that just because skinwalkers is not really part of the Anglo culture. That's why I say Hispanic people and Native Americans. And there's people from those groups today that still don't like to talk about skinwalkers. Some of them don't even like to say the word. But so the belief in a skinwalker is so strong that we had something kind of like the Salem witch trials here in the Southwest back in 1878, specifically in the Ganado Lake region of Arizona. It was called the Navajo Witch Purge. And I don't know if has anybody here ever read the novels of Tony Hillerman, who does like the Navajo tribal police, and they chase down bad guys who claim to be skinwalkers, but then at the end it's kind of like Scooby-Doo, and it turns out it was just a regular person. I'm sure somebody listening's probably heard of Tony Hillerman and his Southwest thrillers. But the real story of the Navajo Witch Purge kind of reminded me of those, because there were no stories of actual wolf people roaming around that we know of, but the way this whole witch hunt got kicked off is fascinating, and it sounds like something from a movie. So how it got kicked off, I guess for some background, I need to mention this was shortly after the Trail of Tears, where the Navajo were forced to walk this brutal distance from their homeland in Arizona to a reservation in New Mexico. And then in 1868, the Navajo were allowed to walk back home to Arizona. So they kind of had two long walks. But this is 10 years later, 1878, and the Navajo are really have fallen on hard times. And there were some mysterious occurrences in their area where their cattle would die and people would get sick, and they started whispering that maybe, you know, skinwalkers and witches were to blame. But what kicked it off is they found a grave that they dug up for some reason. I don't know why they got into this grave and dug it up, but they opened a grave, and in the grave they found a corpse, and its stomach was split open, and in the stomach was, allegedly, the Treaty of 1868 that allowed them to return to Arizona. You know, so it's like, how did a military treaty wind up in the stomach of a corpse? And supposedly this is all true. And so that got the Navajo, you know, really worked up, you know, because they're like, well, that's a cursed item, and there's witches among us. So it basically turned into the Salem witch trials, and about 40 Navajos were executed by other Navajos under the accusations of being a skinwalker, because they all, you know, believed that firmly in it. And so that's why I say it was kind of like the Salem witch trials, but on a smaller scale. So that's one of the stories that I have in my book that is actually real. You know, it's not a folk tale, but at the same time, you know, I'm sure some readers will be kind of disappointed in that story because there's no real monster, or at least not that we know of. You know, I ended my chapter on that by saying, sure, I'm sure a lot of the people that got executed in that purge were probably it was probably done under false accusations, but I did say, you know, I mean, I'm sure at least some of them probably were skinwalkers who had killed people and probably deserved to die. But, you know, our modern mindset now is more along the lines of, well, primitive people back then were stupid and they didn't know what they were doing. And so I kind of argue against that a little bit, you know, and trying to say that, you know, I'm sure some of those people that were executed probably were actually skinwalkers.
Right, but can you execute skinwalkers? That's the question.
So that's one of those fairy tales. Yeah. It's kind of fairy tale like, because with them, it's you have to utter their birth name. Once you utter their birth name and you out them, that for some reason is what helps kill them. And then there's something to do with white ash, and I can't figure out if they're referring to the white ash tree or like literal burnt white ashes that you're supposed to like dip a knife into or a bullet or whatever. So that's all I know about that.
Okay.
I have a story about that kind of goes kind of the same theme as this. We're talking about historic things from the West. I live in this kind of pioneer town called Invermere, BC. And this is the area, John, that I've talked about many times of my what I believe was a Bigfoot encounter, as well as I had UFO encounters here. But the one thing I want to talk about that's historic base is the rumor has it in this town. First of all, the natives in that area are really big believers in Bigfoot. It's like there's things that their grandparents told them about them and everything. So it's like well-known in the folklore of this area. But a big story in this area is that there was apparently a taxidermied Bigfoot there in the 19th century or like turn of the 20th century in this place called Athelmere, which is actually the area I lived. Imagine it being like kind of like Wild West kind of stop in like on your way through mountains and things like that, like through Rocky Mountains. And apparently in this area that would have been like a trade stop, they had a taxidermied Bigfoot there. If you want to do more research, I can look into it a little bit more for you, or if you want to do yourself, Invermere is the town. But that's what the word on the street was there. They had one at one time,
oh,
at one point.
Yeah, Mark, thank you. Yeah, because I don't want to yet, because like if you give me the details, I'll just misplace them. But when it gets to be time, I mean, you know, I'm going to do like a pioneer era of cowboys and Bigfoot type book. So I definitely. When I start working on that, I'll absolutely get with you, because I honestly had never heard of that one, and that's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, it's right in the area where I saw it, and it's well-known. Like there's this famous Bigfoot documentary that came out recently. I don't know the name, it's on top of my head, but it was in that same valley, like not far away. Like it's apparently a hotspot for Bigfoot, and this was what I heard from multiple people. Like, you know, that's what their grandparents told them. It's kind of like, you know, passed down through generations of this area that at one time or another there was this Bigfoot that was taxidermied there.
That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was in Sumter, South Carolina, right next to Shaw Air Force Base, and people who worked at Shaw Air Force Base, it was really funny. We did caricatures with them this weekend at the Camden Irish Fest. When I asked them about that, they said, we can't talk about that. Okay, great. Thank you very much.
That's just an admission that it's real.
Yeah.
Of course it is. It's kind of like when George Bush, 44, was on, I think it was Jay Leno, and someone said, what can you tell us about UFOs? He said, I can't talk about that. Well, that was the admission that there were UFOs.
Exactly.
Come on.
Yeah.
I can't talk about it. So he admitted it. Otherwise, he'd have said,
yeah,
no, there's nothing. So, I mean, just silliness from our politicians and silliness from Marines, ex-Marines and ex-Army guys and ladies. I mean, just, you know. They need to understand that they incriminate themselves every time they open their mouths.
Maybe the presidents don't have the right level of Q clearance or whatever it is that has to do with the black projects that are going on with UFOs and whatever else.
Bush 44 did apparently, and I can guarantee you every one of the presidents knows exactly what's going on. And Trump did it right. He said, I don't know anything. I can't talk about anything I don't know. That was the best answer in the world. It's like, nope, can't talk about it. I don't know about it. Of course he knows everything about it. They let the president know. The president is the one person that knows as much as possible about everything. So, I mean, they have to know that because that's how they run the country, except for Joe Biden. I don't think Joe knows anything. Where they told him and he forgot. But that's okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. We love Joe. We love Joe Biden. He's a human being just like all of us. I didn't say that. Did I really say that?
Is he a human or is he a clone?
Okay. All right, John LeMay, you're our guest. Please continue on. You're so interested. Tonight has been so interesting. Please keep on with your stories, kind sir.
Well, like I said, we can probably talk about this book for the rest of the year. I don't think I'm even going to get into the mummies tonight. The mummies we can do another night because they're really interesting. Unfortunately, you know, there are no stories of, like, the Universal mummy movies. I mean, that's not based in any type of folklore, really. The mummies get up and move around. But, like, I found no stories about mummies walking around the Wild West. But I did find really cool stories about gunfighters from the West who were mummified and became mummies, and their mummies had a curse on them, just like King Tut. So the mummies in the book are basically just mummified dead bodies that maybe had some supernatural elements, but none of them, you know, got up and walked around like Boris Karloff or Lon Chaney or any of them, unfortunately. But
John,
yeah. So
what about like those mounds that are, but you know, those mounds that are all around the West and things, or I know in the States, there's like these big hills and things that date back there a long time. Do you know anything about those? Cause I heard there was, has to do something with burials in these, some of these places.
Yes, I did my second chapter in this book, because in this book I try to do, like, you know, vampire, mummy, werewolf, you know, then something else. I try not to do, like, chapters of the same thing, but the second chapter of the book is called King Tut's Tomb in the Arkansas Valley, and that's about, I mean, there's lots of mounds all over the U.S., but these ones were in Oklahoma. And, gosh, these things sound like a scene from Ghostbusters, because one of the pioneers in 1909 around these mounds that had mummies in them and just, you know, treasure and all of it, and that's not folklore. I mean, that's actual scientific documented finds. If you want to Google it, somebody listening, it's called Spiro Mounds in Oklahoma. So you can Google that real quick and find out this is true. But one of the pioneers had a... Spiro Mounds, she claims she saw fire shoot out of the mound, and then she saw cats come out of the fire pulling wagons. And the reason why I find that interesting is cats, you know, have that connection to the Egyptian underworld. So even though the mummies they found in the mounds looked Mesoamerican, you know, I mean, they looked like from Mexico, South America, that type of culture, as opposed to Egypt, but still, I think the connection there is interesting. So yeah, I did cover a couple of the mound cultures, but I'll probably do every single one that I can in the book that I do later on that's just totally devoted to mummies. So I'm glad you have brought that up.
The other thing that came to mind, too, I just want to mention briefly, is the kind of the Mormons and the Western pioneers, and they have some interesting stories, to say the least, as far as, like, you know, Latter-day Saints and angels meeting them, and they're finding all these crazy artifacts. Do you know anything about that in relation to pioneers? Because it seems like this is something that is kind of something you're kind of diving into.
Yeah, I haven't gone down that rabbit hole yet, because I know it'll just consume me for hours, and I don't want to until I'm ready, you know? But I definitely need to someday.
Because one side of my family is Mormon, and so I know a little bit about it. And it seems like there's some crazy kind of almost UFO type things going on with that religion, and the whole story of like their kind of new prophet and things. It's all pioneers in it, and it's very abstract, really weird. Like when I first heard about it, I was like, "What? No way! Like this is, I can't be." But yeah, I don't know, nothing against Mormons or anything, but it seems like there's something potentially there, too, because they were very much in that pioneer era.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's, so, yeah, Skinwalker Ranch. Each of my books, I like to end on the final chapter of each of those books, I have a tradition that I like to end on, like, a location instead of, like, a cryptid or a monster, like Cowboys and Saurians, the first book, I ended on a chapter about the Lost Valley or the Lost Plateau of the Grand Canyon, where these prehistoric pygmy horses supposedly lived. Then the Ice Age book, I ended it with a tropical oasis supposedly located in the Yukon where dinosaurs and mammoths roam. So for this book, you know, about vampires and werewolves and stuff, I was trying to think, what's a location in North America? Because that's, you know, these books have to, it's the Wild West, it has to be North America. I was like, what's a location? I probably can't find one. And then it finally hit me, Skinwalker Ranch. And even though, you know, Skinwalker Ranch became famous in the mid-1990s, that's when it the reports really got stirred up. They did have paranormal things on Skinwalker Ranch, of course, you know, dating back to the days of the Native Americans. So the final in the chapter in this book is like what did I title it? I gave it some kind of cool title. What was it? I titled it The Origins of Skinwalker Ranch. And it's all about how the Navajo supposedly put a Skinwalker curse on the land because belonged to the Ute Native American tribe that they hated. And so I was really happy to be able to find some old stories about Skinwalker Ranch, which also has UFOs on it in addition to the werewolves, which is really weird.
John, it certainly does. And I can tell you, and this is another discussion offline, I have some discussions in my email from a Mormon elder from Salt Lake City whose family owns the property next to Skinwalker Ranch, and they can't sell
cool.
it. And
yeah, I bet.
That's something you might want to know about. I met him quite by accident. He was a support technician at a web hosting company that I used to use, or I still use, I guess. And it was amazing what he told me. And then when I contacted him about a year ago, he said, I cannot talk about this because when I do, they visit me and they haunt me. And that was
He'll that never was be terrible. Able to leave you.
Do what?
I said, that poor guy will never be able to leave there.
Well, he lives in Salt Lake City.
Nobody's
but
ever going to buy that place.
No, they're not. Nobody's going to buy the land next to Skinwalker Ranch. And it's terrifying. And that's exactly what he told me. So nobody knows. Well, some people know what's going on. But, you know, several people have tried to investigate it, and it just really hasn't worked.
Well,
yeah,
you guys ever heard of,
so, like y'all said, yeah.
Have you guys ever heard of the Bermuda Triangle in the Lake Ontario?
Yeah.
No.
So it's, like, I live on Lake Ontario right now. Like, it's about, like, a few minute walk from my house. And it's not far away from that, but growing up, like, on this Niagara Peninsula here, I've always heard of strange, you know, you have the UFOs, but you also have, like, the water UFO one thing, some things coming out of the water and things. And I've heard
the
of
the unidentified submerged
things.
Objects.
Yeah, and but this like, Ontario Bermuda Triangle, it's more to the east of me, like, upstate New York to, like, towards Montreal area. But nonetheless, I have the hypothesis that there's potentially an underwater alien facility there or something. I believe in the Great Lakes, being such like the location wise, I always thought that that would be the prime place for it. And I've heard people, because growing up, like friends who were like, oh, I saw this fireball come out of there and went over here and things, and all these like stories about weird anomalies happening in the Great Lakes. Potentially there's something to that. Like, if you think this continent.
Mark, there's an author named Preston Dennett. We've had him on ScaryCast before, and he is the guy about underwater submerged objects, USOs. And I'll see if I can contact Preston. He's an accountant, and we'll see if we can have him on here, and he can answer those questions. He has got, I think he's on his third book on USOs, and he's a nice man, and we need to have him back. So I think you'll enjoy having him there, and you can discuss that particular area with him. I'll bet you he knows about it, okay?
Okay. Sounds good.
All right. Well, John LeMay, do you have one more really great story to tell us tonight?
I think I ought to save them for next time, because all the really great ones are long, long, long stories, so... And I told all the good vampire stories. I feel like this was like the vampire night. So, like I said, I think maybe next episode we'll do the mummies. Because, like I said, even though they don't get up and walk around, they have some interesting stories. Their history is just fascinating. Because we don't think of mummies in North America, but we do have them.
I'm sure
and
we
the,
do.
Yeah,
well, let
the
me
book
ask
isn't
you
out
this.
Yet. Yeah.
I was going to say, when can we expect the book being out? And I really need to get a copy of it immediately, as soon as it's out, so that I can at least be a little bit knowledgeable about what you're talking about.
Yeah, so I've got it in my hands, what I call my proof copy, because I can't proofread on a computer screen. I'll miss all sorts of stuff. But if I read it, you know, in the flesh, so to speak, with a hard copy, I catch all these things. And plus, I just enjoy it. So I'm almost done reading my proof copy. And once I input the corrections and click publish, I mean, I might have it out by this Tuesday. You never know. I'm sorry, not tomorrow, but like next week, Tuesday. I bet that's a possibility. So pretty soon,
within 2 or 3 weeks, there might be a copy to buy.
I absolutely think within 2 weeks for sure this book should be out. And again, it's just called Cowboys and Monsters.
Oh, my goodness. What a great title. Well, John, please let me know. We'll stay in touch because we always do. And you're just a monster author to come on here. And we really appreciate you being here. And first of all, okay, I'm gonna say some thank yous now. First of all, the Queen of Scary Cast, Robin McCrae, thank you for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, we love having you here, and it's a lot of fun. Mark Johnston and I would love to have you on Scary Talk, I guess, 2 weeks from tomorrow night. Do you think that would be okay?
Are you talking to me or Robin? I'm sorry.
to Robin.
Okay, I thought so. I was just making sure.
I thought you had gone back over.
No, this is the Robin McCrae moment. Would you be with us on Scary Talk?
Of course. I wouldn't miss it.
We would love to have you, so I'll put that on the schedule. It's on Scary Cast, and right now you can go on Scary Cast to find it. On Tuesday nights, we'll have our own Facebook page, and thank you. We really appreciate you. We love you a lot. You're just such a guiding light for all the cryptid stuff and all the Bigfoot stuff, and we want to thank you so much for being part of our organization and our team. Okay? We love you.
Thank you. Love you guys.
All right. We love you a lot. And Mark Johnston, you are another guiding light. You pestered me about getting Scary Talk started, and it is going to be a phenomenally different thing than Scary Cast, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So I want to say thank you very much, and I'll be hitting you up later tonight to make sure you're okay and talk about some things as we move forward with Scary Talk. And John LeMay.
And I just want to say, John LeMay, I really liked our conversation tonight. He always brings such interesting things to the table and such dynamic and things that wouldn't even consider, like coming with cowboys and cryptids. It's like, yeah, that's awesome kind of thread to go on. And thanks for being on tonight. Thanks for talking, answering my questions. I hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. And I'm on your same wavelength. I don't think you're crazy. Everything you say, I'm on the same page with. So
it's okay to be crazy as long as you accept it and you're okay with it, right?
Yeah.
You know what? I think none of us are crazy. I think we may be the pioneers of research for the future, is what I've got to say. And I think your books are certainly some of the best I have ever read, and I would put them number one in the paranormal literature. So anyway, John LeMay, thank you for being here. We look forward to having you next first Monday as we get into more Bigfoot stuff with the Georgia Bigfoot Conference. April 16th, and we are thrilled to have you here, and I'll do a call around with my friends here as soon as the show is over, and John LeMay, you'll be first. I'll call Robin, and then I'll call Mark. So thank you very much for another groundbreaking, marvelous episode of the one, the only Scary Cast. Thanks a lot, guys. Take care.
All right. Good night, y'all.
Good night, everybody.
Au revoir. Goodbye, Robin.